From Radio Catskills Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Well, coming up, we take a look at Diabetes Awareness Month. Patricio Rubio talks with Dr. Scott Hines, endocrinologist with Crystal Run Healthcare, to help explain what living with diabetes is like and to get tips for navigating what is traditionally a very carby and sugary holiday season. And Radio Catskills' Genevieve Hartnett talks with Ramon Wilson, Executive Director of Sullivan County's Human Rights Commission, about their public roundtable on human rights. It's happening next week at SUNY Sullivan. We'll get all the details. That reporting in just a moment, but first up, we do have news from Albany, where New York Governor Kathy Hochul says holiday shoppers will be able to navigate online purchases with the help of a new surveillance pricing law. WSHU's Janice Roman explains.
A new law in New York requires businesses to disclose when prices are set by algorithms using consumers' personal data. Hochul says it spotlights hidden online pricing tactics. She says consumers get different prices for the same products based on their willingness to pay. Information like a customer's purchase history, location, or browser behavior are collected. That data is then fed into algorithms, which companies use to generate a price specific to the customer. Hochul says the added transparency allows shoppers to make smart choices about their online purchases. I'm Janice Roman for the New York Public News Network.
The American Farm Bureau says putting Thanksgiving dinner on the table is slightly less expensive this year than it was in the last 2 years. But as WAER's Boone Kilpatrick reports, upstate New York shoppers will pay significantly higher than the national average.
For 40 years, the American Farm Bureau has tracked the average cost of a basic Thanksgiving dinner for 10.
Frozen turkey, 16 pounds. $28.27. Whole milk, 1 gallon, $4.07.
That's Amanda Powers with the New York Farm Bureau ticking off the cost of the annual items.
Miscellaneous ingredients, you know, butter, spices, etc., $4.32. Dinner rolls, $4.55. Frozen green.
Added up at a Central New York market.
Total Thanksgiving dinner, $66.06 on average.
A full 20% higher than it did much of the country. But why is that? We asked Syracuse University economics professor Patrick Penfield.
Probably taxes and regulations. That's usually the two drivers, especially in New York. Taxes and regulations, they kind of stifle your ability to lower prices just because you got all these increased costs, so you have to make it up someplace.
For the New York Public News Network, I'm Boone Kilpatrick in Syracuse.
And thank you to the New York Public News Network for those reports. Well, Sullivan County's Human Rights Commission is hosting a roundtable on human rights at SUNY Sullivan next week. The theme is civil and human rights, different roots, same purpose, and it's a way for the community to connect with the commission and weigh in on major issues like housing and discrimination. Radio Catskills' Genevieve Hartnett recently spoke with Ramon Wilson, Executive Director of Human Rights and Consumer Affairs for Sullivan County.
Your work has covered a lot of human rights issues, housing, tenants' rights, racial justice. What do you feel like is the biggest human rights issue facing Sullivan County?
The issue that's more pressing is probably housing. The lack of housing, a lot of discriminatory practices, some evictions that have taken place based on retaliation of tenants who happen to be speaking up about issues that are more than fair for them to bring to the attention of my office and any other organization that can help. Some of these landlords are retaliating against them and not renewing their leases or trying to accelerate having them removed from the unit because they filed complaints. And even in some instances, maybe even leveraging having the tenants remove their complaint from our office in order to stay into a unit. So that's probably by far the most pressing issue where our offices are predominantly more involved. But we do see a lot of employment issues that are taking place here in the county in terms of discriminatory practices and also retaliation, unfortunately. So we're putting together some materials and also some resources to help those individuals as well.
That kind of brings me to the round table that will be happening on December 3rd. Can you talk about what the decision to host that round table, where that came from, and also what do you feel like are the main issues that are going to be addressed?
I've been in my role now a little over 8 months, still very new, still getting acclimated to the county in many different ways, but it'll be the first time that the community have access to me and bring into light some of the issues as we just spoke about, that's more pressing in the county, bringing together some educational resources that happen to be free. We'll have some expert legal experts available on our panel to help answer and guide from an educational standpoint. And in terms of the things that we plan to discuss, it's going to be human rights versus civil rights, how they are different, how they intersect. We'll also be talking about housing issues, which we just talked about is a very pressing issue regarding like the holdover law, specifically how that relates to tenants and some of the things they can do to protect themselves if they are victims of discrimination or retaliation in housing. If you're living in a unit that's not habitable and the landlord or the entity that's managing the property is not taking care of the property, some of the rights that you have and some legal recourse and actions that can be taken. We'll also talk about racial discrimination at the workplace and retaliation in the workplace, and also some pro se for individuals who may not have access to legal representation, some ways that they can possibly navigate the court on their own. So it'll be a great panelist there. We have Judge Danielle Jo Stecker, who's a prominent judge here in the county, who's going to be on the panel. We also have two attorneys, Matthew Peluso, who's an expert civil rights attorney. He's going to bring a wealth of knowledge and tools to that panel. And also we have Maria Zeno, who's also an attorney here and does a lot of work in Sullivan and Orange County particularly, and she's going to focus more on the housing-related issues.
It's been a very turbulent year with the Gateway Housing Project getting pushed further and further back. How much do you work with John Little and his Department of Health and Human Services office? How have you delegated some of the tasks of protecting housing, and what have you done this year so far, and what do you hope to do next?
Yeah, so I've been establishing a great rapport with John and his office. We are working very closely together to devise a plan in this coming year to address the issues as best as we can. Right now, I'm just in the process of collecting data, responding to the complaints in my office, finding what complaints meet the criteria of actual human rights violations, and then preparing those complaints to be sent up to the state. As far as the work that we've done thus far, just a lot of planning and, again, just gathering metrics between my office and John Little's office. And I intend to strengthen that relationship going further as we continue to gather the metrics and the data needed to be able to resolve these issues.
In spite of the work that you're doing and in spite of the work that you do with John Little and the commission, when you were appointed, there were people in the community who were a little bit skeptical about particularly the board assignments, in particular, Bill Liblick. But as a board, how have you used your differences to come together in addressing the issues facing the community? And how much will the board be a part of the roundtable on December 3rd?
I am happy to report that we have a very diverse board. Everyone on that board is doing this work voluntarily, is very well-rounded in the issues that we face here in Sullivan County. I'm sure there may be some perspective that people in the community may have concerning each individual, but my interactions with the board members have been nothing short of pleasant, professional. We do address issues of how we represent ourselves outside of the office that we hold in Sullivan County, and making sure that the residents know that we take this work very seriously. Outside of any controversial issues that the community may have been experiencing, myself, I have not experienced those issues. I think that we are being very proactive with regard to planning and tackling these issues at its head and making sure that we make a difference. You know, the board is going to be more involved, I think, after this round table, which, by the way, the board members will be also present for the community to put eyes on them and see them in person. And I think after December 3rd, going into the new year, we'll be able to lay out a plan. We'll be proactive with each representative of each community as far as the board is concerned to start engaging the community more and bringing information and resources to them.
And before I let you go, is there anything else people should know before the event and how to engage in a way that is both productive and respectful?
Yeah, I think that for everyone who has a lot to say about the Human Rights Commission, now is the time to do so. We welcome healthy and engaging conversations. This is going to be the platform. This is not going to be an event where you're just going to hear from legal experts and myself as a human rights and consumer affairs expert. It'll be an opportunity for now us to listen to the community and hear them directly. And we'll be able to call to action some of these issues that are pressing. But it's been a lot of work here since I've started 8 months. And right now I'm the only one in my office doing everything. So, you know, things are going to take some time to change. And the county has been very supportive, particularly county manager Joshua and Michelle have been extremely supportive of my office. The legislature has been very engaged, and they've been wanting to see this thing really make a difference in the county. So it's a lot of work ahead of us for sure, but we welcome everyone who has issues going on that are affecting them, their civil rights, their human rights, employment issues, to come to this event. It's going to be about the community. It's going to be about them knowing that we're here to support them, and we're putting best efforts forward to do that.
And the event is on December 3rd. And what's the time?
It starts at 11 a.m. I asked everyone show up promptly, as we have a very tight schedule. It ends at 2 p.m. at SUNY Sullivan Community College. It's going to be an opportunity where, again, everyone has the opportunity to be heard. We have a large portion of this event specifically designed for people to speak and express some of the things that they're experiencing here in Sullivan County. So I'm extremely excited. Hopefully in the coming months, by spring, we'll have another event tackling other issues. But yeah, 11 o'clock a.m., SUNY Sullivan. I hope to see everyone there.
Thank you so much, Ramon.
Thank you very much. Look forward to seeing you.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Well, November is a time when millions of families gather for the holidays, and it's also American Diabetes Month, an opportunity to talk honestly about a condition that affects 38 million Americans. Diabetes brings not only health challenges, but also a growing financial burden. The encouraging news? Diabetes can be managed, in some cases even prevented, through lifestyle habits, early detection, and good medical guidance. Patricio Rabayo spoke with Dr. Scott T. Hines, endocrinologist with Crystal Run Healthcare and part of Optum Health, to help us understand more about this disease and how we can all stay a little bit more healthy this holiday season.
In order to understand diabetes, it's important to understand the role that insulin plays in trying to control a person's blood sugar. So insulin is a hormone that's produced by the pancreas that takes sugar or glucose out of our bloodstream and stores it away in our liver and our muscles to be used as fuel during the day when we're active. So there's two types of diabetes, and the presence or absence of insulin is what helps to determine which type of diabetes a person has. So type 1 diabetes means that a person is not able to produce insulin at all. Oftentimes, this is diagnosed in childhood, although there are adults who can develop type 1 diabetes. And since the underlying problem here is the body cannot produce insulin, the only way to treat type 1 diabetes is to give a person insulin. Now, that only represents about 5 to 10% of people who have diabetes. So 90 to 95% of people who have diabetes have type 2 diabetes. And this is where their body is able to produce insulin. However, they're not able to produce enough insulin to overcome something called insulin resistance, which is where the body produces other hormones that prevent insulin from doing its job. And so as a result, the blood sugar, the sugar stays in the blood and causes all sorts of unwanted consequences.
Mm. You know, I'm hearing that, like I said earlier, that 1 in 5 people who have diabetes don't even know it. If you want to just talk about that a little bit, what are the warning signs that people should be paying attention to?
Sure. So the symptoms of diabetes are often noticing that you're urinating more frequently than usual, that you're hungrier than usual, but not able to gain weight. So you eat, but are not able to gain weight. Sometimes blurry vision can tip somebody off that they have diabetes. So at that point, patient already has pretty severe diabetes by the time they have symptoms. And the goal is to really to diagnose diabetes prior to those symptoms developing. And so this is why the USPSTF, which is one of the federal task forces that make recommendations in healthcare, they actually recommend screening patients between the ages of 35 and 70 who are overweight or obese every 1 to 3 years for diabetes. And the goal of that is to try to identify this disease before it becomes so severe that it causes symptoms.
Now, are there certain groups who might be higher risk for developing diabetes or pre-diabetes?
Sure, that's a great question. So one thing people always think about is is hereditary, their genes. There's diabetes in my family, so does that mean I have diabetes? When it comes to type 1 diabetes, 90% of people do not have a family history of diabetes. Only about 10% of people with type 1 diabetes have a first or second degree relative that has type 1 diabetes. The story is very different for type 2 diabetes. In patients who have type 2 diabetes, about 60 to 70% of those patients have a first or second degree relative who has type 2 diabetes. So genetics definitely does play a role, particularly with type 2 diabetes. But the other thing that really plays a role is, particularly in type 2 diabetes, is lifestyle. If somebody is overweight or obese, their body is producing more and more of these, what we call counter-regulatory hormones, or other hormones that are preventing insulin from being able to do its job of pulling sugar out of the bloodstream and storing it as fuel. And those hormones are being produced by fat cells. And so through diet, exercise, weight loss, folks have less and less of those fat cells, which means that they have less and less of those counter-regulatory hormones, which means that their body's natural insulin is better able to do its job and lower the blood sugar.
So let's say you get that bad news that you're newly diagnosed. What are some of the biggest lifestyle adjustments that could a person make after that to overcome this diagnosis?
The cornerstone to any treatment plan for prediabetes or diabetes is lifestyle. It's diet and exercise. And the thing that I constantly tell my patients is that, you know, living with diabetes or prediabetes is a marathon. It is not a sprint. And so what is important is to come up with strategies that you're going to be able to live with for the rest of your life. So saying I am never going to eat bread again, or never going to eat pasta again, or never have a bagel again, is not realistic. There are very few, if any, people that are going to be able to completely eliminate these things out of their diet, nor should they. It's part of a naturally, you know, healthy, balanced diet. So what I always preach to my patients is it's moderation. Anything is okay in moderation. And so, you know, thinking about carbohydrates, and the way that I explain carbohydrates is there's two categories of carbohydrates. There's things that taste sweet, simple sugars like cookies, candy, cake, fruit, juices. And then there's complex carbohydrates, bread, rice, pasta, potatoes, you know, starches. I don't tell people they can't have those things. What I tell them is to be careful with how much and how often. And so if they are wanting to have some pasta for dinner, that's fine. But measure out a serving size, or maybe 1.5 servings. And if you look at the back of any box, it'll tell you a serving, you know, what the serving size is for that particular brand of food. If you have a serving or a serving and a half of complex carbohydrate, and then fill up on meats and vegetables, that's okay. That'll help to keep your blood sugar in good control. The other thing when thinking about diet is to increase the amount of fiber that's in their carbohydrates. The more fiber that is in a person's carbohydrates, the less it'll impact their blood sugar. So those are some simple things with diet. But then exercise is just as important, if not more important than diet. Either aerobic exercises, running, jogging, bicycling, or resistance exercises such as weightlifting, help the body to more efficiently use blood sugar, and helps to keep their blood sugar in check. And then as a result of dieting and exercising, trying to lose a little bit of weight will go a long way toward managing a person's prediabetes or diabetes. And the other thing that I like to mention here is that we're not expecting people to always lose huge amounts of weight. There are plenty of studies now that suggest that losing anywhere from 5 to 10% of your body weight can help to make an enormous difference in managing your blood sugars. And so if you have somebody who weighs, say, 200 or 250 pounds, you're talking about 5 to 10% is a 10 to 20 or maybe, you know, 12 and a half to 25 pound weight loss over the course of 6 months. I think setting realistic goals is very important when it comes to talking to patients about weight loss.
So, you know, we're entering the big holiday season. You know, Thanksgiving is coming up. And you mentioned earlier about doing things in moderation. So what advice do you have for people with diabetes who want to spend time with their family and enjoy the holidays, but still stay healthy?
That's a great question, particularly this time of year. And again, I think it comes back to, you know, moderation, not elimination. And so if you want to have a piece of apple pie or pumpkin pie, you should, but, you know, have a serving size of a piece, you know, have, you know, a 16th of the pie, not a quarter of the pie. You know, if you're craving mashed potatoes, that's great. But have a cup of mashed potatoes. Don't, you know, just kind of take scoopful after scoopful. And I think the other thing to remember is that, you know, Thanksgiving is one day a year. And so if you deviate a little bit from your typical diet plan on diabetes, that's okay, as long as you get back on track, you know, the next day or the day after that, that the holiday doesn't stretch out to be many, many weeks.
What's one thing, Dr. Hines, that everyone sort of misunderstands about diabetes? Is there sort of a misconception that goes around that you'd rather or you want to dispel here?
The thing that I would like people to think about is that diabetes is not their fault. It's not anything that they, you know, did or didn't do to, you know, to develop diabetes. Diabetes is a very complex disease that is a combination of genetics and lifestyle. And I think when people start blaming themselves, then it becomes sort of a defeatist attitude and they are less motivated to make the necessary lifestyle changes that will help better treat the disease. And so I think that, you know, people should just look at diabetes as, you know, a condition that they have developed and that they have the ability to overcome through diet, exercise, weight loss, and in many cases, medication management in collaboration with a physician.
Now let's talk about a treatment of diabetes. Once you are diagnosed and are starting to live with diabetes or start treating diabetes, what are the medications out there? You know, my personal experience with diabetes and my family, you know, I watched my mother go from taking medication, taking pills, to insulin. I see other people's in other parts of my family go through dialysis. So what is sort of the game plan?
Sure. So typically, the first, you know, again, cornerstone first line treatment for diabetes is lifestyle management. It's diet and exercise and weight loss. But many times in many patients, that's not enough or may not be enough right out of the gate. And so we would have to use some prescription medications in addition to that. The field of diabetology has changed over the course of the last 5 to 7 years, where the type of medication that is recommended for a patient now really can vary based on a few different things. One, other diseases that the patient may have. If a patient has a history of heart disease or a history of kidney issues, there may be a certain type of medication that's recommended for those patients. Whereas if a patient doesn't have those things, there may be a different type of medication that's recommended for those patients. And so we really do look at the whole patient now when thinking about diabetes and the other conditions that patient has. We also think about the risk of low blood sugars. So there are certain types of medications that can cause, that are more likely to cause low blood sugars than other types of medications. And so if you have an elderly patient who lives alone, you probably don't want to use a medication that has a high risk of a low blood sugar. And then lastly is cost. You know, so there are some medications that are generic and are not very expensive. And then there are some medications that, you know, may not have a generic alternative and may be expensive depending on the patient's insurance and financial condition. So you have to take that into account as well. And so I think when you are, you know, discussing with your provider about what is the best medication to use for diabetes, it's important to think about the whole patient and all those things that I've just mentioned. I do want to mention one other thing just about insulin, because I've found in my practice there's a lot of misconceptions about insulin. And there are a lot of patients who say, I'm never going to go on insulin because when my grandmother went on insulin, you know, a month later she passed away, or a month later she had to have an amputation. And they sort of equate insulin with the end of life or a very severe stage in diabetes. And that may have been true, you know, 30, 40 years ago, where insulin was withheld until patients were so far gone with their diabetes that there was nothing left to offer them. But I think it's important for patients to realize now that we use insulin a little earlier in the disease state now, or a lot earlier in the disease state now, to get their diabetes under better control. And the most important thing to prevent all of the horrible complications that you hear about in diabetes, like blindness and amputation, kidney failure and heart attacks and strokes, is to get their blood sugar under very good control. And it doesn't matter what medication we use for that, as long as we get their blood sugar under better control. And many times insulin is the best way and quickest way to do that. And just because you're get put on insulin when you're diagnosed with diabetes or early in the disease, it doesn't mean you have to be on it forever. Many times we use insulin to try to improve patients' blood sugars and reduce their insulin resistance, and then we can transition them over to pills or other medications in the future.
Do you want to discuss medications like Ozempic? You know, diabetes is in the news because of that medication. People are using it not for diabetes, but are using it for weight loss. I don't know if you want to talk about that trend that's happening.
Sure. So medications called GLP-1 agonists, which are the class of medications that Ozempic and Mounjaro fall into, which many people have heard about through the press, that class of medications has actually been available for many, many years now. It's just changed over time from a twice-a-day injection to a once-a-day injection to a once-a-week injection. And the newer injections, again, like Ozempic and Mounjaro, have been shown to allow patients to lose oftentimes a significant amount of weight. And in patients who are obese, who have type 2 diabetes, and particularly in patients who have a history of heart disease in addition to their diabetes, medications like Ozempic and Mounjaro have been shown to be very beneficial to help them lose weight and to help prevent future heart issues when it comes to diabetes. So it appears that these medications help to control diabetes, not just by allowing people to lose weight, but also by the underlying mechanism of action of the drugs and helping the body better utilize sugar.
And how about those folks who are using this diabetic medication who are not diabetic just to lose weight?
So these medications have been shown to be effective and safe in patients who are overweight or obese who do not have diabetes. I think that in many cases, helping patients to lose weight through medications like Wegovy and Zepbound, along with a healthy diet and a regimented exercise plan, can help patients from going on to develop chronic diseases such as prediabetes, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. So I definitely think that it's a conversation worth having with your primary care provider about whether or not these medications are right for you.
When does a patient go on dialysis? In my experience, and for my, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, of course, you know, it seems like that's the last option treatment before having like a kidney transplant.
Yeah. So kidney disease is one potential complication from diabetes. It often occurs many years after the diagnosis of diabetes in patients who have rarely or never been in good diabetes control. In patients who are controlling their diabetes, the risk of kidney failure and dialysis is very, very low. But in patients who have gone many years or decades with very high blood sugars, over time, that does damage to your kidneys and eventually can lead to end-stage kidney disease where the kidneys don't work anymore and you have to have a machine filter your blood for you, and that's what dialysis is.
Well, Dr. Hines, before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on do you want folks to know about?
I think just, again, reiterating that any chronic disease like diabetes is a marathon and not a sprint, and that it's something that folks are going to have to learn to live with for the rest of their life. And so it makes sense to discuss with your provider what is a reasonable plan of care for a chronic disease that can last for many, many years.
Well, thanks to Dr. Scott Hines from Crystal Run Healthcare and Optum Health for joining us today. We talked about what diabetes is, who's most at risk, the steps people can take to prevent and manage it, and how to stay healthy during this holiday season. So, doctor, again, thank you so much for talking to us. I do really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for the time.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Patricio. That's it for the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. I'll be back here with you tomorrow night. Stay with us now for The Daily coming up next. This is Radio Catskill.
Sign up for Radio Catskill's free weekly newsletter. Get the latest local news, culture, and things to do in your inbox every Friday. Stay connected and informed with Radio Catskill's newsletter. Subscribe at wjffradio.org.